You're listening to Greater LA. It's KCRW's show that connects you to the people and places of Southern California. I'm Steve Chiotakis. Today, we're flying over Southern California. That's the sound of wind rushing through the feathers of a California condor taking flight. With a wingspan of nearly 10 feet, think about that for a second, 10 feet. It's the largest land bird in North America.
It's a huge bird. You know, a turkey vulture, for comparison, has about a 6-foot wingspan, which is pretty big.
That's Steve Kirkland. He's the California Condor Field Coordinator for the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service. His job is to help save a species that went almost entirely extinct about 3 decades ago. At one point, there were only 22 California condors in the wild. But the elusive bird reached a historic milestone you may have missed with everything going on in the news lately. Back in May, for the first time in half a century, 4 condors were spotted touching down at Sequoia National Park. KCRW's Catherine Barnes tells us why biologists are so excited about this moment and the journey that's led up to it.
All right, come on in and I'll latch it behind us.
It's lunchtime at the Santa Barbara Zoo. I'm here to feed a California condor, along with my colleague, KCRW's Matt Gillum. We step inside a hidden cave, about to launch a furry, frozen meal through a little hole.
Staring up at me are several dead white rabbits. They're cute, they're fluffy.
Like some type of morbid magician, Gillum grabs some gloves, lifts a rabbit out of an industrial-sized bucket, and prepares to do the honors.
You gotta shove it in. You kind of have to launch it a bit so it goes all the way through.
Oh, dear God. Let me see you do it. Oh, you're pushing hard. Okay.
Yep.
This is a two-handed operation, you know? All right, and off you go, little friend. And now they're out there.
All right, you can throw your glove in that bucket.
As the condors start pecking at their furry meal, Gillum and I talk to Rachel Richeson. She works with birds at the zoo and is facilitating this lunchtime buffet. We ask why we're feeding the condors through this hole rather than out in the open.
We don't want the condors to see us feeding them. We don't want them to be used to people providing food. With a nearly 60-year lifespan, these birds could end up in the wild. We don't know what their future holds, so we don't want them any more acclimated to people than they need to be.
As we head out of the cave and into the daylight, she tells us that while most zoo animals stay in zoos for their entire lives, condors are different. These 4 giant birds now gnawing on frozen rabbits are part of a special program meant to save their species. See, the California condor has had a long and tumultuous history. They once dominated the entire North American landmass, stretching from western Canada all the way to Florida. These scavengers feasted on the remains of woolly mammoths and giant ground sloths. As European settlers arrived, the condors took refuge in the still wild California. But soon, that became less wild, too. More and more people descended into their habitat. Hunters and ranchers began using bullets containing lead. And while the abandoned animal carcasses were delectable treats for these vultures, those lead fragments proved lethal. Biologists say lead poisoning is still responsible for half of all identifiable condor deaths. By 1982, the wild population was down to just 22 condors. Richeson says to avoid extinction, all the remaining birds were trapped.
So the decision was very controversial at the time, but the decision was to catch all of those birds and bring them into human care to be put into a breeding program to try and save the species. So it's one of the most dramatic undertakings to save a species where every known animal was taken out of their natural habitat.
A captive breeding program began at the LA and San Diego zoos, later expanding to Oregon and Idaho. Like a matchmaking service, the staff carefully paired sexually mature condors with one another, supported their offspring, and then sent those kiddos off to other programs in order to make more babies and diversify the population. A decade later, in 1992, the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service teamed up with partner organizations and began releasing some of those condors back into the wild. In Southern California, they're taken to the Los Padres National Forest at the Bitter Creek National Wildlife Refuge, about 2 hours north of L.A. The Southern California flock now includes about 100 wild condors. And as the population grows, so does its geographic range. They've been spotted in Santa Barbara, Los Angeles, Fresno, and beyond. Here's Steve Kirkland from the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service again.
We've had condors actually fly over the Sierra Crest and spend a little bit of time near Whitney Portal, near Mount Whitney. We've had birds up near Shaver Lake and Bass Lake, so pushing toward the southern boundary of Yosemite National Park.
And now, rather than flying overhead, this unflappable species is beginning to touch down at Sequoia National Park. More than a half century ago, condors built their nests in the carved-out sections of giant sequoias. Kirkland hopes to see those nests return.
Giant sequoias are amazing trees, and having condors, which are the largest land bird in North America, nesting in them, I think we all probably think that that would be a really exciting thing to see again.
Separate flocks continue to prosper in Central California near Big Sur, Arizona near the Grand Canyon, and the Baja Peninsula in Mexico. Richeson from the Santa Barbara Zoo says the expanding range makes her hopeful.
I fully believe these birds will recover. I think we're well on our way to the recovery status where, you know, eventually they'll be downgraded from critically endangered, perhaps to endangered or threatened.
But there's still a long way to go. Biologists continue to educate the hunting and ranching community about the dangers of using lead bullets. It's not a human versus condor issue, though. In fact, Kirkland says hunting and ranching is crucial to the condor's survival. That leftover game is a primary food source, and ranchers who maintain open land provide condors with a vital habitat.
You know, hunting plays a really important part in the ecosystem, both by providing food for scavenging species like condors and golden eagles, but also, you know, in terms of contributing to open space. And so hunting is really, you know, the key to the recovery of this species. It's simply just switching to non-lead ammunition.
More than 300 condors fly freely above North America today. Maybe one day you'll even spot one yourself. For KCRW, I'm Catherine Barnes.
Introducing the KCRW donation car, designed to be recycled. This first-of-its-kind vehicle will save you time, space, and hassle by disappearing. Enjoy the luxury and comfort of turning your underused car into a donation worth hundreds, even thousands of dollars. The KCRW donation car, already in your garage, driveway, or on cinder blocks outside your house. Act now at kcrw.com/cars.
Welcome back to KCRW's Greater LA. I'm Steve Chiotakis. As coronavirus cases continue to surge in Los Angeles County, one key tool that'll help re-flatten the curve is identifying the folks who have the virus and identifying those they were in contact with. Contact tracers are here to help.
You know, my mother used to say, always look for the helpers. Anybody who is coming into a place where there's a tragedy.
Oh, baby, have it now. All I need is my brother.
Because if you look for the helpers, you'll know that there's hope.
contact tracer can nail all the minutiae down, but they also have to be able to reach people to do that. Barbara Ferrer, who's the director of the LA County Department of Public Health, said that less than half of people with COVID-19 who've been contacted by the county have provided information about their close contacts. Those are likely people maybe fearful of giving information, personal information, to county officials. Now, we've discussed on this program how some city employees, like librarians, have been tapped by the government for that job. But turns out there are others volunteering to contact trace. Denise Swindle is an actor and server who just finished her course to be a certified contact tracer. Hey, Denise.
Hi, thank you.
Lupi Leva is a senior librarian in Boyle Heights working as a contact tracer, and we've talked to her on this program before. Lupi, welcome back to you.
Thank you so much for having me.
Denise, I'm going to start with you because you literally just finished an online course to be certified as a contact tracer. Tell us about that course. Was it like taking your driver's license test?
So I saw a friend had done it on Instagram, and I clicked around, and it was a free course authorized by Johns Hopkins University. I'm sort of obsessed with information at this time, which we all are, just trying to get as much information as we can. And it is like 11 hours, but I just binged it. And I wasn't necessarily looking at it as a job, a future job at that point. But then I was like, this could be something for me to do. My server job is gone. The acting industry is gone for, you know, the time being. So, yeah. And then I could work from home if I want to. I'd be helping people. So it just all sort of fell in place.
Who were the folks behind the test? Like, where did you find this test?
So it's called, it's Coursera, C-O-U-R-S-E-R-A, and the course I took is COVID-19 contact tracing, and I got a certificate, and they gave us checklists of things to do when we are, you know, handling a case or a contact. So I haven't pursued it at all at this point. So I'm not an expert by any means, but I did find out some really interesting things that I didn't know. You know, contact tracing has been around forever for food poisoning or syphilis, what have you. I think a lot of people just sort of, I assumed this was something that was just COVID related. But it's helping people too, because it's helping the sick, the exposed. And being an actor, an improviser, getting people to open up with open-ended questions and getting them comfortable to tell you, sounded really groovy for me and my personality. And also at the end of calls, you know, if they're freaked out about money or if they, you know, are afraid to, you know, quarantine, you can give them resources for things, for food or things to get help while they're sick or, you know, quarantined.
You are just beginning your journey in contact tracing, Denise, but we do have someone on the line who's an expert of sorts, Lupi Leva. You spoke with our reporter, Danielle Chiriguayo, last month, and we wanted to check back in. How are things going with you? And did the process that Denise just explained, was that something that you had to go through as well?
I went through a slightly different process. As you mentioned, I'm a librarian, and I work for the city of LA, so we have a disaster service worker program. Now, I do have a friend who's an epidemiologist, and she suggested the same course, the Coursera Johns Hopkins course. And so I took that, but I actually had training from the LA County Department of Public Health. They did provide training. Part of my training was actually also done in conjunction with the California Department of Public Health and UCLA. So I actually took, it was about a week-long course provided by the LA County Department of Public Health.
What is it you say if you're a contact tracer? You've got to cold call people, right? And say, "Hey, look, were you in contact with so and so? They just have discovered that they're positive for the novel coronavirus, and you now need to quarantine." I mean, you're essentially telling people they have to change their life for the next 2 weeks, right?
Yes and no. Actually, one very important thing to remember is the confidentiality aspect of it. A lot of the training is HIPAA. And one of the main things is that you never tell people who it was who identified them as a contact. So confidentiality is a huge thing. You do have to talk to people and you do have to let them know that they've been exposed. You do have to let them know that they do have to quarantine. They have to change their lives. You have to know the difference between isolation, which is for someone who's sick, and quarantine, which is for someone who's been exposed. And you do have to explain things like that to people. Like Denise mentioned, you also provide resources. You provide referrals because it's not an easy thing to have to stay home for 10 days to 14 days and not go anywhere. People have needs, be they needs for groceries or needs for income. Sometimes your income is interrupted. And a lot, like I said, of our training was based on what is confidential? What is confidential information? How do you handle this confidential information?
It makes a whole lot of sense, actually. I wonder if when you're making these calls and you say, hey, by the way, you've been exposed to COVID, you have to upend your life now for a couple of weeks. You can't go anywhere. People are going to have to do things for you. Or if they visit you, they're going to have to put on a, or they can't visit you, right? So you've got Denise on the line right now, who's about to embark on this journey. I would suspect that some folks aren't very happy about it. And maybe there's a little barking that goes on the line. Does that happen?
You know, I think for the most part, my experience has been really positive. And I think for the most part, people either already have an idea of what's coming or, you know, I think the people who maybe don't want to talk to us just simply don't answer the phone. And, you know, that happens quite often. People just don't answer the phone. But I think most of the people that I've actually spoken to have been grateful for the information. Of course, as a librarian, I have a lot of public contact in my day-to-day job, and I'm used to dealing with people who are very happy with my services and people who are not very happy. And I think it's very similar. You do get a wide range of people, but I think for the most part, I think people really appreciate the support. And, you know, for the most part, my experience has been that people are eager to do what they have to do.
Denise, the course was so long. You said you binged it. For 11 hours, I can't even imagine, although, you know, I've watched a few episodes of, like, you know, 6 Feet Under for that long. What about the certification process that drew you in, that makes you want to do something like this?
I think that the part I would really enjoy and I would be good at is actually listening to what people have to say and getting that information from them. Because you do have to be sort of patient and also give, like, open-ended questions to get them to talk.
I mean, this is a greater good kind of thing, right? I mean, and the more contact tracers we have and the more people who know that they have this or have been exposed to this and perhaps, you know, stay cool for about 10 days to 14 days, that the disease won't spread. We can get a control of this. I want to thank you both. Denise Swindell, who's a newly minted contact tracer, Lupi Leva, who's a senior librarian in Boyle Heights working as a contact tracer. Thanks to you both. Good luck to you.
Thank you so much.
Thank you so much.
This is Greater LA on KCRW. I'm Steve Chiatakis. Spending time in a confined space with lots of people you don't know may seem unsafe during a fast-spreading pandemic, which means you have a big decision to make if you rely on public transportation. A lot of folks have made the decision to find another way to get to where they need to go, and that means fewer people are taking buses and trains. Well, that dip in ridership is leading to a dip in cash flow for public transport agencies all across the country, from the BART in San Francisco to the vast subway network in New York. But here's a bit of good news. Metro, here in Los Angeles, saw some of the smallest dips in ridership compared to other major cities across the country, and riding it may not be as risky as you think. Alyssa Walker is urbanism editor at Curbed and a contributor here on Greater LA. Welcome back, Alyssa.
Thank you, Steve.
So walk us through some of the latest numbers reported by Metro. I mean, how's it doing in terms of ridership compared to, say, pre-pandemic times?
Yeah, you've probably heard these very frightening statistics in other cities and heard a lot about how people are afraid to ride transit or not riding transit. But here in LA, we've managed to hover at about 36 to 38% of ridership, which is actually really good compared to some cities you've seen that you're down to only like 10% of their regular ridership. So we're doing better, and we have done a lot better than many major cities. you know, we haven't seen those decreases because we really, our stay-at-home order was quite short. We've kind of opened back up. People are going back to work. A lot of people rely on transit in this city. And I think this is highlighting, if anything, this is really showing how many people actually do need transit to go to work and that we have to keep it operating for those people.
What kind of precautions have you taken when you've ridden the Metro buses and trains?
Yeah, I took all the regular precautions that are proposed by Metro, wearing a mask, bringing hand sanitizer, washing hands on either end of my journey. There are some sanitizing stations that are set up at some of the stations and bus stops, so that's really good. And then when you get on to the buses or trains, you just want to make sure you're distancing yourself from other riders. So hopefully you're on one of these. Some of the routes, they put longer buses on, so you have more space, which is really great. And then, you know, they're keeping the drivers and the operators protected by having, you know, the police tape is kind of like roping off the front of the bus to kind of keep it as their own special space there. And then they have, you know, plexiglass barriers to protect people from getting in too close a contact with riders.
So what are the risks? I mean, you mentioned hand sanitizing, maintaining social distance, things like that. Do you know whether riding buses and trains right now puts you in any danger of getting the virus? Or is it less risky than maybe you might think?
I think so. I think there's been a lot of studies done in places that have either, you know, kept their transit running at very regular service throughout the entire pandemic, places like Japan and South Korea, and then also in places that have reopened, that were kind of shut down and reopened in France and Milan. And they looked at where clusters are occurring, and really no major clusters have been tied to public transit. And I think the one thing we need to really think about is keeping our operators safe, keeping the employees safe. But I think just like overall, the culture of mask wearing is really what's being attributed to keeping these clusters from happening on transit. And especially if you look at a lot of the Asian countries, places like Japan, which has just become a part of daily life to wear your mask. So mask wearing is important. It's why Metro is actually giving away free masks in some instances.
Let's talk about the other cities that I mentioned at the outset, which is San Francisco, particularly San Francisco here in California. The Municipal Transportation Agency, they call it Muni up there, had to get rid of half of its lines, right?
Yeah.
Those are the streetcars up and the buses up in San Francisco, right?
San Francisco is facing a crisis, really. In addition to everything that you mentioned, it'll have to make big decisions about Caltrain, which is its regional rail network. I think there's two things that are happening in the Bay Area. You know, they have so many transit agencies operating in the same region, and really not a lot of coordination between them. We have a few. We, of course, have a bunch of different ones operating, but Metro is quite large and quite influential. But we also don't rely very heavily on fare box recovery in Metro's, you know, budget. Fare box recovery is basically just the fares that you're collecting when people get onto the buses and trains. So in many cases, this makes up a big chunk of transit agency's operating budget because they are really relying on that money to be able to provide more service. And ours is a smaller portion of our overall budgets.
Looking forward, Alyssa, is Metro still expanding? I mean, you know, we had grand plans. There's public financing of all of this stuff, you know, lines that are being created, the Crenshaw line and, you know, all these other ones going toward the airport. Is all that still on the table?
Crenshaw line is delayed quite a bit, but it is still moving forward. And some other things I've noted, like you said, too, that we had these great next gen bus plans. I think they're really going to revisit them and look closely at who's been taking transit this whole time. How can transit serve them the best going forward, making sure that it is communities that have not gotten great service or great improvements are being prioritized.
Things that we will talk about on this program. Alyssa Walker, urbanism editor over at Curbed. Alyssa, thanks.
Thanks, Steve.
That's all the time we have for today. Tomorrow, they are everywhere across greater LA. Think about the Sunset Strip. Think about LA Live. WeHo, West Hollywood, is going all in on digital billboards. How does that make the neighbors who like it less bright feel? And a talking dog? Sorta. A canine that one woman says can communicate by keyboard. But is its technique a little rough? Ugh. Make no bones about... Oh, I'm so sorry. Make no bones about it. We're online at kcrw.com/greaterLA. You can fetch the podcast while you're there. Share your thoughts, biting or not, at kcrw.com/greaterLA. That's all I'm going to do. I promise you. Jenna Cagle, Catherine Barnes, Jackie Ugrinovsky, Sonia Geis, Mario Diaz, Phil Richards, Ray Guarna, Mario Saavedra, Jody Adler, Mike Newport, and Christian Bordahl all help make this show happen. I'm Steve Chiatakis. Thanks for your ears and time. Have a great night.